This is Sci-Fi for Me.
We are talking with Måns Marling and Bjørn Steen, the co-directors of the new Underworld Awakening, the fourth installment in the Underworld franchise. This one being the return of Kate Beckinsale, I think, is probably the biggest selling point of this film. Now, you guys have been co-directing since the very beginning. You've been collaborating pretty much your whole career. What difference has it made? I guess let's start with your process. How much has your co-directing process changed since you first did Disco Kung Fu?
Well, that's a really good question, actually. I never got that question earlier. You know what? Not the whole damn lot. We still have the same idea that we do pre-production back-to-back next to each other, holding hands, kind of. And then we do the actual shooting every single day, you know, when every second day. When Bjørn is directing, I'm his best buddy. The next day we turn in, and I'm the director, he's my best buddy. And we came up with that idea during Disco Kung Fu, and we actually haven't changed it at all since then.
Now, how much of a difference has it made with in terms of budget? Because your more prominent film that got you noticed, Storm, had a budget of only $3 million, and now with Underworld Awakening, you're in the big leagues, sort of. You've got $75 million to play with. How did that affect your approach to your filmmaking process? What differences did that make in now you've got all of these resources on hand? How did that affect your process? What did that do to you?
Well, first thing, I mean, filmmaking is very traditional, so there's a lot of, it's very conservative, and so a lot of people become like, they question us, what do you mean directing every second day? What do you mean year two? So in that sense, we haven't changed anything in how we work. What has been different is that we get so much more resources, as you say, so it's easier to make your visions come true. But filmmakers is always the same, that you'll never have enough resources. Because, I mean, if we had $75 million to do Storm, yeah, that would be great. But we're making Underworld Awakening, and that's a film that also demands a whole lot of money. So it always feels like you're always out of money, kind of.
Yeah, I mean, the basic approach is always the same. We just try to tell the story in the best way. For us, I think the change was more that after we kind of got the assignment and the job, we were told that, oh, by the way, guys, it's 3D. And that changed more in terms of how we need to conceive a story visually.
So the 3D, did that affect just the way you were going to shoot things, or did that affect the actual story itself?
More the way you shoot it, I would say, not the actual story. It's not like they're, running around pillars just to get a cool 3D situation. But the way you tell the story is different. It's not immensely different, but it's kind of in many ways limiting in the tools you have. You kind of go back a little bit in time and say, well, the camera is much bulkier, and there's also some stuff that just aren't pleasant to watch in 3D, like when it's two handheld cameras, stuff like that. You just get, seasick seeing that. So we had to rethink that a little bit, and it was also interesting because we had no real experience in what the end result would be in 3D. I mean, nobody did. We just had our DP, photographer. He had done one movie, and that was about it. In the experience of the team there. Of course, there were technicians in their stuff, but just in terms of being kind of a storyteller, it was very uncharted territory. So it was that was the challenge.
We were striving much more to do single takes, long takes instead of fast editing, because the 3D is more prominent in longer takes because you can feel it, you're in the room more. So I think we pushed for that much more than we would in an ordinary film, a 2D one.
Now, you mentioned the crew having to make adjustments to your every second day style of directing. What kind of adjustments do you have to make coming into a franchise as opposed to creating something out of whole cloth, doing an original picture? Because you've just been handed the fourth movie in an established story universe. How did you have to make any adjustments in your approach to the story itself?
Well, the thing is that it's both a blessing and a curse, because we all know what we want to do, and everybody, I mean, we are fans of the Underworld movies, so that was easy. We really wanted to do this one. That was good. The bad thing is that everybody has done the films more than we have, so we were like the new kids on the block. Then again, everybody was very on board the fact that this is number 4 in the series. It's not number 3, which means we are taking it somewhere else. It's not concluding a trilogy. We need something new. Most of our ideas of how to change and revamp the series was embraced very warmly.
How difficult was it to get Kate Beckinsale to come back to play Celine? Because she wasn't in the last one. Was that?
Yeah, well, it wasn't difficult at all because she's married to Len Wiseman, who's the creator of the series, and I think he just convinced her.
I think that was solved in Len's and Kate's kitchen. You know, I think it's time you can make another Underworld movie. Yeah, I think you're right, and that was it.
How easy was she to work with on the set, being the star, having gone through this, you know, a couple of times already, playing this character? How much conversation did you have in the development of where Celine goes in this story, as opposed to just letting her do her thing because she's played the character before?
Well, the thing is, the scene speaks for themselves. The thing is that I told Kate once while we were shooting, wow, it's I never seen any actor who so easily can just step into a role as you do, because she's Kate Beckinsale, who is charming and she's always laughing and she's always very funny and quirky, and then she's Celine, death dealer, and that happens in 30, you know, half a second. So she said, well, it's because I've done it so many times, so I'm so close to this character. But then there are so many scenes in this movie that are not like, there haven't been scenes like this in the other movies that are more sensitive and more emotional. So I think, I mean, we talked about to Kate about these scenes, how shall Celine come across and so on. And, but it was kind of obvious. We followed the script, and Kate is she's a wonderful actress. You follow her instincts, and she's that perfect mix of being very true to her emotions and touch you, but she also knows the film medium, which is a very technical medium, so she can combine those two, which is, for a film director, she's lovely to work with.
Now, take us through the story. It's 12 years later. Celine wakes up, I'm assuming, after being in some sort of suspended animation, and I'm guessing we're going to get some kind of explanation as to where she's been. And she wakes up to a world where humans know about the existence of both vampires and lichens, and there's a little bit of conflict, I guess you could say, about that circumstance. So what is she stepping into?
Well, here's the thing. I mean, here's where the film's mystery starts. Compared to the other movies, I think this one is driven much more with the mystery. She wakes up, yeah. But before she wakes up from her cryo, man has already found out about the creatures of the night. The lichens and the vampires are being eradicated in a most ghastly genocide way. It's not a war, actually. It's a wipeout. You can say, well, the vampires and the lichens are so much, so superior to man. But man has one thing that they don't have, and that's numbers. They're purely, outnumbering these creatures of the night. And so she wakes up, and she starts having these visions. And the last thing she saw before she got shut down or taken out, or what one should say, was Michael. So she gets convinced that the visions that she's having are Michael's. They've done something to her brain to connect the two, because she wakes up in a lab. So she gets sure that I'm seeing through Michael's eyes. So she starts following these visions, and they take her through a journey of finding Michael.
That leads to a question that has been burning up the internet for a while now, whether or not Scott Speedman is playing Michael in this movie. There's a lot of hints that she's looking for him. Is that one of the surprises in the film? We're going to find out what's going on with Michael?
That's the mystery Moses is talking about, so let's keep it a mystery. Yeah, that's a mystery. There's other mysteries. That's not a simple answer to that question, I can say.
Now, the movie comes out January 20th. What are your plans after that? Are you doing the next Underworld film, or are you moving on to something else?
You never know if there is a next Underworld film. This one has to come out first, I guess. No, we don't know yet. We're just, you know, we're literally scrambling to finish this one right now. So, as we're speaking, we're doing the final dubs of the music, which was supposed to be done the day before yesterday. But there's so many sounds and there's so much, so we're running late, and we have a really, really short delivery date. So we've been working, I think, 13 months with this movie, and our agent and manager are dying to send her stuff, but our whole devotion has turned to this movie. I mean, we have been reading stuff, but there's nothing that really hooked to us, or there's things that we do like, but we don't know anything yet.
All right, well, we will let you get back to work on it. Mons Marlin and Bjorn Steen, thank you very much for your time today, and good luck with the film. It is Underworld Awakening. It opens January 20th in both 3D and IMAX 3D. We're looking forward to seeing what happens to Celine and finding out about Michael.
Thanks, man. Take care.
This has been a presentation of SciFiForMe.com.